Basically, that's what we were trying to figure out how to do. How to send a message out into the cyber environment and have it listened to. How to make a noise in the space that makes a difference. And part of the process of doing that is to become your own producer, to recognize it. And so part of the idea of Cyber 2 is for us as a group to constitute ourselves a production company. In the process of doing that, hey, Xander. In the process of doing that, we're going to explore the rhetorical space in rhetorical terms. As what is a message? Of what is it constituted? It's not like it's a mystery. It goes back to Aristotle. But actually getting the idea so that you feel it and can not only work with it but extrapolate from it, that's a big deal. So we know, Aristotle teaches us, a message comes through to us. Like a triangle. It's got character to it. Somehow the speaker has force of personality. It has trajectory to it. That is, the message resonates with something in the listener. And it has logic to it that gives it clarity, gives it power. So when a lawyer stands up in court, they are testifying, they are representing by advancing their character with as clear a message as they can project. So that's what we're going to do. That's what we're trying to do. Now, next. As I say, Cyber One is, in a sense, my project. The thing I'm interested in teaching. The idea that one could actually become active in the cyber environment as a teacher. And so, the paper that Rebecca and I put together is about... It's about the aspiration of a teacher, teachers, who see the potential in internet space to reach a much larger audience and to have it work just as well for the audience that's far away as the audience that's close. That's what that paper is really grappling with. My project. I realized that after yesterday going around and introducing, I didn't quite introduce myself, although I certainly talk enough. So I'm Charlie Nesson. I grew up in Newton, down the way. Went to Exeter, went to Harvard College, went to Harvard Law School. Traveled in Europe for a year on a fellowship, clerked for a year on the Supreme Court, worked for the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division for a year, accepted an offer to come back here to teach. Taught for 3 years, got tenure, and then took leave for 5 years to go figure out what I wanted to do. Did a bunch of litigation. Worked in a defender's office, worked in a private office, got involved in some big civil liberties cases. Wound up spending a couple of years out in Los Angeles litigating a case called the Pentagon Papers case with a marvelous teacher. and then came back to Harvard and started teaching evidence in 1975. The connection through to this subject is really through evidence. Evidence is all about storytelling in the environment of the courtroom. And so when you see a new medium opening up, it just naturally attracts narrative instinct. At least that's what I feel. And I was a math major in college. Actually, had worked on a computer as an undergraduate. Wrote this program that I told you about, 1980. 1994, got a little grant from, I forget who it came from. I think it came from Court TV, $10,000. And I used it to rent 8 Quadras, which were like the Mac hot machine at that point, and put them in my evidence class and had teams of students, no, 20 Quadras I rented. Teams of 8 worked on groups for like a week. And then we brought the machines together in wherever it was, Austin, and actually linked them together and had a network. And so we were like on the net. And it was just, you could see where this thing could go. Right? And at the outset, this net is an open environment. I commend to you the Wikipedia entry on Richard Stallman. It's worth your reading. He's like the guru of open code. If you want to follow through and have some fun, read John Perry Barlow's Declaration of Independence. It's got that open spirit to it. So what's my passion? My passion at this point is to support the open net. That's what the Berkman Center was about. And specifically at this point, to bring in poker as a support for the open net. Now, I don't mean this has to be your project, this is mine. It's also Andrew's. I have to tell you about Andrew. We're playing in the public service auction poker tournament 2 years ago, which was this wonderful tournament that took place in Harkness Commons in conjunction with the public service auction. Must have been, how many entrants? 120 entrants. And each of us put up $20, which all went to public service. You know, there wasn't a money prize. You were just playing for the idea of coming in first at Harvard Law School. Had a wonderful night, except that I got put out by this redheaded kid that called me when I shouldn't have got called. And so he puts me out of the tournament. That was how I met Andrew, really. And we have joined together as partners in the enterprise of legitimating poker. And specifically, well, here's why I bought this. Last year, we couldn't have a poker tournament. Tell them why, Andrew.
The Attorney General of Massachusetts wrote a letter, or an opinion letter, that he decided that poker games, even for charity poker games, were classified as lotteries in the state of Massachusetts. And so he indicated that as such, you have to be issued a permit in order to hold a poker game, even if it's completely for charity. And the way it was structured here at Harvard, it was a suggested donation. So it wasn't even required to pay. It was just suggested that you do so. And he issued a letter that said, if you want to hold the tournament, you have to apply for and get a permit. And by the way, we're not issuing any permits for poker, since poker is a lottery. deciding also that poker is a game of chance, in which case you have no better chance of winning at poker than you would at the lottery. So that, I felt, was an inaccurate portrayal of poker. And so that kind of led into...
Well, I was personally affronted by this. I mean, the idea that we're not able to run a poker charity tournament without getting some official to say that we have to, it just seemed outrageous to me. And I have to say, added into that was the fact that I'd really enjoyed playing online poker myself. And abruptly, last October, I couldn't play anymore because the federal government had put through a bill as part of a Port Security Act, this part of the bill never having gone through any committee, pushed through by Frist on the last day of the session, and wham, all online gambling, online poker, stopped in the U.S. What they did was they, well, tell them what they did, Andrew.
The Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act is attached to the Safe Port Act. I don't know if you guys remember or not, but there was a big to-do about whether or not, you know, U.S. companies had to own and operate the U.S. ports. There's, and so in retaliation of that, they passed the Safe Port Act. And at the literally the 11th hour, like 11 o'clock p.m. on the last day that the bill was going to be voted, Frist attached this amendment language called the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act. And what they did is they attacked internet gaming in general by prohibiting any American financial institution from transferring funds to an internet gaming site. That included poker, sports betting, any online casino, except it didn't include horse racing, which I thought was just fantastic and a nice little victory for the horse racing industry. But this whole thing resulted in what had been a very large industry anywhere, I mean, estimates were anywhere from, you know, several, like $8 billion a year up to like $50 billion a year. And at least roughly half the money coming from the U.S. essentially evaporating overnight. Publicly traded companies had to divorce themselves from the U.S. market. A couple of privately traded companies still accepted U.S. customers, but the customers weren't able to transfer the money. And so what Congress had done without allowing any sort of debate over it was essentially attach this Internet Gaming Enforcement Act bill to a terrorism national security bill that no congressman could actually vote against. And Frist was attacked pretty heavily about it in Congress, but it went through, and so now it's difficult to play online.
Yeah. And when you think about it, the things that have driven the net out, the industries that have driven the net out, pornography was probably the leader. And poker was pretty much right behind. Poker has been a tremendous driver of the net. And so here all of a sudden, it basically is made illegal in the United States. And so at any rate, I feel I've come to represent online poker. It's like, who am I? I represent online poker. And I'm a lawyer in cyberspace. It's my project to legitimate online poker. I want to do it in service of an open net. The open net has benefited poker. Poker can benefit the open net. And that's basically a project that I embarked on out of Cyber One, and I'm still totally invested in. With Andrew, as an executive director of the Global Poker Strategic Thinking Society that we launched in Singapore earlier this summer. One of the things I learned through the process was how you launch something. In fact, I would say one of the greater failings of Cyber One last year was when we got student projects ready to launch, we really didn't know how to do it. But I feel like we've been learning, and we have some extraordinary coaching And in a sense, what I'm hoping that we can do here in this class is treat my project, in a sense, as a learning platform, and then segue to your projects, and in the process, figure out how you do one of these things, how you actually put together a message and launch it in the cyber environment so that it hits, so that it makes some kind of wave. And I am clearly still learning as we go. This, to me, is the front of the wave. This is how the future is going to work as far as law is concerned. When you think of the cyber environment, it's really above states. And we're very used in law school to thinking of law as the creature of state. And without state, some people think there's no law. But clearly there's structure in the environment that's supranational. I think it's largely built in the architecture of the space. It's Lessig's message, law is code. And when you see the institutions of the future emerging in architecture, coded architecture, so that the buildings in the space are the Facebooks and the Wikipedias, those are structures, social structures, then you get a sense, all right, let's see if we can understand this environment. So my method here is, first I want to lead you, if I possibly can, to understand from scratch. And so the assignment for next week is for you to write a scratch program. And my daughter, Rebecca, who is TAing for Harry Lewis, who's a professor in the CompSci department and is herself a doctoral student in computational linguistics, and taught with me last year and is teaching a course in virtual worlds, which you can all, in a sense, tune in on. I'll put the link on the wiki. She will be here to teach you Scratch and to workshop what you've done. And there's easy instructions for how to get started that are on the wiki. The whole idea is to engage it and have some fun. It's not like this is going to be a graded exercise, but it is something that I just very much urge you to open yourselves up to doing. That's great. And then beyond that, I want to go over the program with you. So, next week, programming from scratch in a virtual world, and programming workshop. And then the week following, we're going to do Rodney King, which is basically watching a video. I do it in my evidence class, but it's just something I would want you to be exposed to. And week following, Becca back for Second Life. Really getting ourselves immersed to a point. All right. On October 8th, there's a class which I've called the Principle of Law and Prosecutorial Abuse of It. And in a sense, this is the biggest project, this class. In some way, the biggest idea. If you look over Langdell there, at the entrance up at the top, it says, I don't know what it says. It's in Latin, and it says not under men, but under, and I think it says under God and under law. But basically, the idea is not under men, under law. That's the idea. That is the principle of law, the idea of law as an ideal that you aspire to live by and to administer to the extent that you're part of it, as opposed to law as an instrument of the executive for accomplishing executive policy. The executive is the man. When the man says, I want this and I want my prosecutors to get it done, that is the opposite of government under law. And I believe that we are in a place in United States history where the idea of law as an instrument of executive power has become almost accepted. And this particular class is focusing on this question. My guests for the class at this point confirmed, Harvey Silverglade, who is a longtime civil liberties lawyer here in Boston, a close associate with Alan Dershowitz, who has written a book on just exactly this problem. And Matt Feinberg, who is a practicing lawyer here, primarily criminal defense, who has a view of it. And my interest in this, in terms of poker, focuses on the fact that poker is being prosecuted as an expression of executive authority, not through an expression of law. And I'm eager to put the focus on that. All right, so one of the things, Andrew, you want to jump in?
Can I just add just one thing?
Yes, please.
In the whole concept of prosecutorial misconduct, in the larger context of law in the court of public opinion, and in line with what you were saying, I mean, there's kind of this idea that's become acceptable that law becomes an instrument of executive power. And I think that poker is an example of that, in so much as what a lot of people don't understand is that there's never been any law passed, particularly on the federal level, that would prohibit poker or would prohibit online gaming in any sense at all. The only thing that's ever been passed is the 1961 Wire Act, which says specifically that it prohibits the transmission of any information used to make a wager on sports betting. That's not the exact language, but it specifically says on sports betting. Now, the Justice Department has said specifically that they consider online poker, online gaming, to be included under sports gaming, and to be included in the language. Now, it's quite clear that the legislature didn't mean for poker to be included in the language of the 1961 Wire Act, because it never occurred to anyone in 1961 that you'd be able to play a poker game across state lines. But the Justice Department has decided that that's so. Now, there's no court opinion.
Yes, there is. There's Fifth Circuit opinion.
But that limits poker illegal?
No, quite the opposite. That limits the statute to sports betting.
Back up the Justice Department's assertion that poker is included under the 1961 Wire Act. There's no statutory authority for that. Even the UEGA, the Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act that was just passed through, does nothing to criminalize poker. It only criminalizes the financial transfer from financial institution to whatever, or financial institution to a gaming site. So this whole attempt from the executive branch under the Attorney General's office to go after poker, and they've done it in a number of different ways. For instance, they've threatened all sorts of television networks not to run any poker ad. That's why if you see a poker ad on television, it says like partypoker.net or something .net, which is not a gaming site, and there's like a division between the gaming side of their companies and a play for free side. They've done things like threaten the World Series of Poker that they can't accept entrants from an online gaming site. If they do, they'll prosecute them. And they've gone on what's essentially a campaign of what I would call intimidation to sort of attack this game with essentially no legislative or statutory authority to do so, simply because they've decided this is an undesirable element, which I think comes back to the core of this class, that cyberspace and the expansion of the internet has fundamentally changed the way that law is practiced, and that the availability of communication now and the segmentation of communication means that as advocates or as attorneys or as lawyers, or whatever you want to call our role, we have to be fluent in this language of the court of public opinion. How do you operate in this atmosphere where law has become something that people accept as a tool of executive power without looking to just a courtroom and just statutory or legislative authority?
So I should say, I've asked Andrew to assist me with respect to the parts of our class that relate particularly to poker. So I hope you don't feel like he's being too intrusive when he's invited, in a sense, okay? So that's cool, but. Yes, Nick?
Maybe we can talk about this later, but don't you think that the same detriments that apply to gambling in general and casinos that have led to them being banned by a lot of states and specifically in constitutions, state constitutions, don't you think that those could also apply to online gambling and online poker?
Yeah, in fact, that, in a sense, says what my was about. Before we just keep going as if, like, this is the agenda, let's talk about this, because poker is very controversial. Poker has a whole history of baggage to it. There's plenty of issues about whether here you want to be part of an enterprise that somehow is my project that relates to poker. And I would definitely want to talk that through before I just go barging ahead. And certainly one of them is exactly the question. The critics of poker would say it's addictive, it's immoral. There are religious injunctions against it. It's, what else would we say?
Well, it's really easy to lose money quickly, and potential. I guess to me, the reason I'm skeptical, maybe this relates to personal, you know, full disclosure, I lost like $500 in poker in like 2 days on the internet.
You did?
Yeah.
Nicholas, I am amazed. How did you do it?
Because this is why one of the reasons I'm skeptical is because you start off, I don't know if this happens to everybody, but I started with $50, you know, and it went up to like $300.
Playing what stake?
Relatively quick.
What table were you playing? Stakes were you playing?
I think 1-2. Jeez. Must have been 1-2.
Let's just halt. Halt. If anybody decides that they want to go online and start playing poker, it's true, you should start at the 1-2 table. But that's not $1, $2. That's 1 penny, 2 penny. You should play at the lowest stake you can get to until you can earn your way forward and figure out where it makes sense. $1, $2. I don't play the $1, $2 table.
Yeah.
So here you are, you wise punk. You get online and you figure you're just going to march right in.
Yeah. No, I mean.
So now tell us what you learned for your $500.
I learned not to do it anymore.
That's the way it is in education, isn't it? You try something new, you fail at it the first time, you decide, I'm not good at that, and so you never do it again. Right?
Well,
and that works in lots of people, it works in math.
I have too short of an attention span, particularly with a computer. I'm better like in person because I can have conversations with people and keep myself occupied even when I'm getting crappy hands and I keep folding. But on a computer, I'll just get bored and I'll say, oh, you know, what the heck, I'm going to bluff it. But that's also where my skepticism comes in, because how do you explain my, you know, going from $50 to $300 the first time I played, playing very much the same way I would assume that I've played afterwards when I went and then, you know, So then I lost that, and then, you know, I buy in for another 50, lost that, bought another 100, lost that. You see how it goes.
I'm amazed.
But I'm skeptical.
And you got into law school? How did this happen?
I think they could easily set it up, and none of the computers are regulated, and none of the algorithms are there's no watchdog in the Cayman Islands making sure that this is all legit. So they could easily set it up so the first time you play, you make money. And then, bam.
Why would they do that?
Because they want, because...
What? Like PricewaterhouseCooper, an accounting firm, audits a couple of the big sites.
Most of them are audited.
I know PokerStars, Paradise, I don't know what site you were on, but do have like official accounting.
And it's incredibly random, audit. Right? Yeah. Poker is a zero-sum game. So the house has no advantage in, or the advantage they would get by inducing you to play, by making it perhaps more probable you'd win your first time, would be so negligible compared to the enormous risk if someone found out that their games were rigged.
Because it gets more people playing.
It gets a lot more people playing.
Yeah, jump in.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't prove it, but I have a friend who played a ton. I played it and had some hot streaks and cold streaks, but had a roommate who made thousands of dollars a month playing it. And he swore there was an algorithm that gave you hot and cold streaks to keep you addicted to the game.
I can tell you how the Full Tilt algorithm works, right? They sample white noise. I know this, I talked to one of the programmers who wrote their random algorithm. They sample atmospheric white noise, which is apparently the most random element that humans can compute to numbers. And what they do is every card as it comes out is randomized. So instead of like, you know, when you play a regular poker game, they would shuffle and they deal out the cards, and the cards are in the order once they start dealing. They don't keep shuffling, so the cards are in the order they're gonna come out. The computer in Full Tilts, for instance, which is an online program, continually shuffles the deck. The Full Tilt program, he as the programmer, does not know which card's going to come out until the moment that it is dealt to the player, right? And the moment it's put on the table. And he's had it audited by, I think, it might have been PricewaterhouseCoopers, but it's certainly one of the large accounting firms. Because for them...
It wasn't Arthur Anderson, was it?
Well, I mean, for them, their entire value is in customers knowing that the game's completely random. Because if it came out, right now, like, I mean, they were making, especially before Yuija went through, to give you guys a sense of how big it is, Party Poker, which was the biggest, which had about a 50% market share in the U.S., was about 75% larger in annual revenue than Amazon.com. I mean, they're making so much money that the risk of them getting caught for having an algorithm versus the maybe 9% profit margin they're making for that would be like versus a total loss of business.
Nonetheless, it's a real fear.
Yeah, sure.
And people have been fearful of it, and who knows? Yeah.
I think the valid aspect of what you were saying is just that there's no entry to newcomers trying it. And it's not something, you can be a professional and you can be an amateur. Just like investing in the stock market, a lot of people jump in and start buying stocks that are going up, and they lose money because they don't know what they're doing. If you lose money in the stock market, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's no rational element to the stock market. It just means that you're kind of, you know, an amateur and you're playing around with something you don't really know too well, and that there's no barrier to kind of prevent you from doing that.
Oh yeah, and I'm not saying that like I'm a good player and that therefore, you know, since I lost this money, it must be rigged. I'm probably pretty bad, you know?
I mean, you know, I personally lost, you know, when I first started playing, I lost because it was bad, and now I win because I'm okay. And I think like, you know, the same thing with any new game, it's kind of hard at first, and if, you know, you're gonna win some and you're gonna lose some, there's gonna be some variability.
But you can, but you can't, well anyway, it's... Sorry.
Yes?
One of the recurrent themes in cognitive science and game development in particular is that humans are really, really bad at perceiving randomness correctly. And in a lot of games, they'll actually, like, they'll have random numbers that are pretty random, but they'll actually filter it to make it look more random to people. So, like, some games will filter out streaks, filter out, like, three of the same number in a row or whatever. I can't think of any particular game that I know that has this, but I've talked to a lot of people.
I can imagine. Yes.
I was just wondering whether in Play and Online, could you have different skill level tables? Because if you didn't have different skill level tables, then you need the person who goes and loses lots of money to keep the person who's winning lots of money happy. I mean, does there need to be, do they have it so when you go on Online Poker, you can go on a starting table, which
you start at the one penny table, I feel like you probably won't be playing against professionals. I would imagine.
Professionals, yeah.
Right. I mean,
so that's the same, you have to decide where you start.
I think so.
But, I mean, isn't a core element here, though, like, all of the levels we've talked about are all various questions about how to make the game more fair or something. I would say the value of poker is that it models life in so much as it's not fair. I mean, if you lost $500 2 days in a row, what did you learn about yourself? When you were talking about it, what you said is that you weren't as interested in a computer, that you needed a face-to-face interaction, that you continually bought in because you were, it would seem to me that you were kind of bored, you thought there must be a way to win at this, and that you bought in repeatedly after you lost. All of things which to me would say, like, well, okay, we're facing a world that's becoming more and more internet commerce, internet-based communication, IMs, emails, et cetera, et cetera. And what you've learned to through what you were doing is that you do much better at face-to-face communication, that you shouldn't handle any significant negotiation over the internet or over an email, that you should make sure to pay attention when you're working, that you're not spending too much time on a program, because your mind's going to wander. You're not going to be as sharp as you would be if you called them on the phone or you dealt with them face-to-face.
Sure. That may be completely true, but I think that probably applies to humans in general.
Sure.
And so that's what the great danger is with online poker, is that, especially in my case, I think it doesn't seem as real when you're saying, okay, I'm going to put another $50 on this machine, and here's my credit card number, than it does if you're like putting $50 in cash down on a table and counting out the money. It's just, I mean, I've played in casinos too, and for the record, I'm overall up by a couple hundred dollars. But it's, I just think that there's an enormous potential, and I luckily didn't lose my house or something because of this, but I can imagine that there are people out there for whom this is a great danger.
But then is the solution to that stopping progress? I mean, we're moving towards an internet culture. It's pretty much unstoppable at this point. Is your answer to stop that move, like ban it, just because there's a potential for abuse?
Here, jump in here.
Isn't that why we ban some drugs?
I also am against that.
Me?
Oh, I thought I saw your hand. Oh. No.
Just a related point. I mean, I think that the idea that people don't take money seriously when it's on a computer, I think, is kind of a general point. Like, people overspend when they kind of click on Amazon and other things like that. I think, you know, if that's true and we want to kind of make a regulation based on that, would we want to just ban all online purchases or all online transfers of money? Or, I mean, I think that instead, the point is rather that, you know, maybe we should think about how we introduce people to the game if we're concerned about them putting too much money in at first, maybe have beginner sites, or think about intelligent ways about designing the game, not necessarily kind of putting a bound on people's freedom on the net.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, if I had been banned from playing in the 1-2 table, might have been a good thing.
But I mean, Amazon.com wouldn't ban you if you were spending too much money.
Right, I don't think I have a problem with that.
But I mean, so it's your personal problem. So like, I would say that like, if we're interested in learning, or as educators, or as legislatures looking to pass laws to benefit society, you're doing your consumer, you're doing your population a disservice if you're not preparing them for the world and preparing them for the fact that money doesn't mean as much to you, or teaching them, or using, you know, games of skill to teach them lessons. I just feel like you're sticking your head in the sand over an issue that has the potential of enormous benefit.
Well, I love the fact that you raise it, and I'm worrying. It's not a moral objection. That's like a public health objection. This is going to cause people to lose too much money.
Yeah, which I think is a moral.
It's got something to it. How about moral objection? People feel it? How would you feel about teaching poker to kids? Does that rub you the wrong way? I think teaching poker to kids, I mean, we should protect them from this.
They're the easiest ones to win off of.
Say again?
They're the easiest ones to win off of.
Yeah, I got you. There you go.
So the only moral objection that I see is actually kind of a moral objection to maybe the internet. So I think it's not unique to poker, which is that it is addictive. This kind of idea of addiction, I think, is maybe somewhat relevant. Like, people become, I think, addicted to, I personally have been known to become addicted to the internet, my mobile device, or whatever kind of communication with technology that I'm using. Now, and I think that same kind of thing can happen with poker. I don't know if we want to ban it because of that, but I think that, you know, if we're worried about excess and excess taking over, you know, people's lives, it may be a bit of a moral issue that we should be concerned about. I don't think we regulate it. I don't think we should necessarily regulate against it because that issue exists.
All right, so let me get back to the thread that I started here. Suppose we are constituting ourselves a production company. What are our assets? What have we got to work with? Well, one thing we have to work with is an excellent room. This is a fine room. And we've got plenty of extra seats in this room. Another thing we have to work with is a video camera. It's a fine video camera. At the moment, it's totally unmanned, and therefore making the dullest possible video. But nonetheless, it's suggestive of the potential if you start thinking of this as a self-producing company. Let me put it this way. Suppose you think of this class itself as a story with characters in it. And somehow, part of the idea is to produce this story in a way that invites people to it. So, students have traditionally been in the role of listening and taking notes, basically being passive. And a lot of the classroom structure is built for that. But the idea here is to work against that. Make the transition to recognizing that you're a producer. You're working in a team of producers. So, all right, I've on my project of producing, I've asked Andrew to be my assistant. But I would love to engage you in the project as we go, to the extent that you're willing. And I would love then to demonstrate as we're going along producing it what the thought process is in production. What is it that we're actually thinking we're doing? Not just the merits of the argument, but the actual mode of projection of it. And I would love you to be thinking as you're going along in these early stages of the class, just in the back of your mind, what's your project? Is there something you actually feel strongly enough about so you'd like to invest yourself in seeing it change? I don't insist that you have such a thing, actually. There are lots of people that don't. You don't have to feel like somehow, oh my God, I don't have such a thing. And lots of people are pretty happy with their existence. You know? You heard the story of the kid that didn't talk until he was 8? He was out to dinner with his parents, never said a word his whole life. At one point, he shocked everybody at the table by saying, "Waiter!" And the waiter came over and he said, "This steak is too rare. Take it back." And everybody at the table said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. We didn't think you could speak. How come we've never heard a word from you before?" And he said, "Because nothing before was ever wrong." Well, there are some people like that, and it's perfectly okay. You don't have to have a passion to change anything. You'd be really just happy with the whole scene. But I'd love you to be thinking if there's something. Doesn't have to be a big deal. You look down the list of what the kids got involved with last year and allow yourself to get immersed in some of them, you'll find them extremely interesting, I think. Extremely. All right, so what do I mean by produce? I mean, okay, let's imagine that Harvey Silverglade, who is going to talk about this big issue that is kind of on the table in Washington right now, with Gonzalez having resigned, a new attorney general coming in, and all of the questions about abuse of the attorney general's office in terms of the way law was instrumentally used for executive purpose. So the whole question of whether that's a culture in the Department of Justice, not just an attribute of the leader, and whether it's possible in some way to address the culture and change it, so that the idea is when you're pursuing the law, you're actually trying to think of what the ideal is rather than what the executive wants. That's on the table now. I think we might be able to, I just had lunch with Phil Hyman today and Alan Dershowitz. I wouldn't be surprised if we couldn't get one of them to sit in and have it actually be something about a major issue in the country at this point in terms of how it's going to go. And there's going to be a new AG named. He's going to have to go through difficult confirmation hearings. All of the issues about what we expect out of an attorney general, it's there for us in terms of a legal subject to think about and relate to. And so I'm thinking, let's see if we can't make it an event that these people here come to our class. Who else would we like to join? Or who would we think would be good to have in the audience? Who could sharpen it? What is the production power that we have? Well, we have one extraordinary power. It's the biggest power that you have here at Harvard. It's the invitational power. You can invite someone to come to a class and they will take you seriously. They may not come, but people like to come to Harvard to participate in something. So if we are thinking about an issue and we're thinking about, well, who should be the audience and what should be the means for reaching them, now you begin to think in terms of the cyber structure of the class. That's kind of the idea. And so when we get to your projects, we can help you think that through in some way. Try it out. That's the idea. All right, so here I put this up. And let me see. I want to play this for you. This is a short interview on NPR, and I want you to listen to it with the Aristotelian structure in mind. I want you to assess it in terms of three criteria. The character of the speaker, as you get it coming through, just take it from the digits, nothing else you know. The clarity of the message, and the trajectory. And then see if you can say in just one sentence, what's the message? Short sentence, just almost a snippet. What is the message? Okay, let's see if I can get it up here. Great.
Looks like the volume's on mute. The volume rate.
Come up here and help me.
You got it. I blowed your hair out.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And then the source muted.
Try turning that up.
Uh-huh. All right, I'm going to give you this as a take-home assignment. My mentor in life is a guy named Fred Friendly. Fred Friendly was Edward R. Murrow's producer at CBS, then became head of CBS News, then he got fired because he broadcast too much about McCarthy. Then he became a high-level guy at the Ford Foundation, who had a great deal to do with founding Public Broadcasting Corporation. And then he saw a law class. Actually, Arthur Miller and I did a conference. He got very excited about Socratic method, and he then did Socratic seminars for years, privately and then on TV. And Fred had one line that has always stuck with me, and that relates to these situations where you're trying to get something to play and you can't do it. Technology is out to fuck you. That was his big lesson. All right, so now, if we're not going to do that, I'm going to do the next thing I wanted to do, which is to go back to the main page and continue with where we're going. So after Harvey Silverblade, the following week, I am hoping to do a class in which we talk about what I think of as strategic thinking, poker strategic thinking, but largely this idea of thinking in terms of what stuff looks like from the other side. And I've invited two guests to lead that session, both of whom are quite extraordinary, and I may include a third of a different stripe. But at the moment, Howard Lederer, who is known as the professor and is truly an eminent poker player, but also just a remarkably articulate, intelligent man, will be here. And also a guy named Crandall Addington. I've invited him. I haven't yet got a confirmation from him. But if he comes, he's an extremely successful businessman, who was the winner of one of the earliest World Series. No, I think he came in second. Am I right?
Yes.
Came in second World Series. And just, again, a very articulate character about the overlaps in strategic thinking and business thinking. And so that's, in a sense, another opportunity for what could be a very interesting production event. Right. Oh, and I also want to say something else. Somewhere along the line here, and as early as it makes sense, if this makes sense to you, I would like to do an instructional session on poker and actually teach you how to play. Now, I'm slightly uncomfortable doing that as part of the actual class session unless everybody is really up for doing it. But if that's the case, then part of what I've been developing is an approach to teaching poker to beginners. I, as I said, encourage my students to learn it, particularly women. And the difficulties of getting into poker are often right there at the first step. And so a little good instruction right off the bat can amazingly have you playing the full-blown game that's played in the World Series of Poker in one instructional sitting. That is, we could go through an instructional session and play a tournament if we want. So we don't. We're not going to, at least not right then. Although, that gets me back to another subject. So I start by teaching you one card war. The idea is that the real architecture of the game lies in the way the betting works and the positional advantages of who bets when and what the betting options are. That's the thing to really understand about the game. Whereas most of the time when it's taught, people are initially hit with the hierarchy of the hands and get very confused about, is this hand better than that hand? Is this hand better than that hand? And it's just the wrong place to start. So we start with a totally simplified game in which the hierarchy is just dead linear, no problem, one card. But all the betting is the same. And then work gradually from there up to the full Texas Hold'em. And it just goes smooth. We play with Hershey's Kisses, have a good time. So we can do that whenever we want, either after or part of the event here. All right. And then following that, October 16th, there's a session called Asymmetrical Litigation. And the particular example deals with rhetorical poker, what I think of as rhetorical poker in a lawsuit brought by Antigua against the United States. But in a sense, this idea of asymmetrical litigation could be the idea for the whole class. And essentially, the idea is a David and Goliath idea. If you think of yourself as starting out with a project to change something, you're up against something huge. And how does the little person setting out tip over the big structure? So the idea in asymmetrical litigation is how does somebody start with practically no resource and develop it into quite a remarkable exploration. The guys that I've invited, a lawyer named Stephen Danziger, who is himself an exemplar of this asymmetrical litigation. He's now in the late stages of a lawsuit that he brought in Ecuador against Chevron for degradation in the Ecuadorian forests by their oil exploration, and has progressed with that case to a point where there's just billions of dollars at stake, and Chevron is definitely on the defense. He's not going to talk about that case, although it might make sense if there was a human rights group here who was interested in environmental kind of human stuff. This is all related to Indian stuff in the forests. It might be that some ancillary event would make sense for him. But he's going to be here with a guy named Jonathan Cohen, who is the leader of an excellent public relations firm in New York. And Jonathan is also part of the group that's working on this poker project. And the two of them, together with a trade expert named Simon Lester, we'll be talking about this extraordinary case that Antigua brought against the United States in the World Trade Organization that starts out with tiny little Antigua finally now putting the U.S. in a position where it's significantly on the defense. Antigua sued one at the lower level, one on appeal. The United States then withdrew its commitment under the World Trade Organization treaty for gambling, and it's now open to damages from all of WTO countries, and it's going to arbitration at this point. And so it's much more complex than I can give it to you in one sentence, but you will get the full feel of it. And it's definitely an interesting one. I've invited Zittrain to come and talk about generativity. I'm not sure yet of what date he'll be here, but I'm pretty sure we'll get him. I invited Lessig to participate on a session on corruption, and I don't think that Larry's going to be able to come, but I definitely want to talk about the subject with you. And then I want, in a sense, to wrap up my project and clear the decks for yours and leave the rest of the semester for focusing on the projects that you're generating. And who knows, there may be something else bubbling along that, like target of opportunity as we go, but it's very much the design that this be our project, and we make of it what we will. Now, in terms of constituting ourselves a production company, first of all, I kind of feel like I'm dragging you along. Would this be okay? Is this a way to proceed that would be okay for people? Anybody object to this? Come, let me hear if I'm pushing too hard. All right, great. Fantastic, in fact. All right, so now the question is, what skills have we got here? What production skills have we got? What have we got that we can actually use to help each other? You came forward wonderfully, suggesting that you're able to be a help on the things that have to do with programming. That's terrific, and we'll definitely use you. What talents have we got here?
I look damn good on television.
All right.
Just taking a step back, when we're talking about a production, are we talking about just generally crafting a message that has some traction or something that can grab a hold of something in cyberspace and just media in general, aiming at those particular dates? I mean, the whole concept behind looking at these issues and crafting a message out of there that has something to it? I mean, with an eye towards the whole Court of the Public Opinion idea? Is that what we're trying to create? We're trying to produce, in a manner of speaking?
Yeah, I think so.
So which audience are we trying to reach?
It's part of what you have to figure out.
Related question, like, is this only kind of Second Life? It's, when we think about cyberspace, I mean, there's...
No, it's not just only Second Life. We're not... In my seminar, the trials in Second Life, that we're going to do in Second Life. This class is going to get acquainted with Second Life, but you don't have to do your project in Second Life.
So in terms of the audience and reaching the audience, I mean, we can think of things like Facebook or other social networks as kind of a forum for distributing content.
Yes, in fact, one of the more successful projects last year had its takeoff in Facebook.
Which was that?
I don't know. I'm going to have to go review. Let me see if I can find it. I think it was Spank No More. This was a project to increase sensitivity about spanking, obviously, and I'm pretty sure that was the one. But basically, that's what people were doing last year, was trying to figure out, how do you light a fire under your message? How do you do more than put up a web page that nobody ever looks at? Right.
I get the sense that people are maybe a little confused as to what message we're exactly trying to craft and why, or like why this is important.
All right, let me see if I can try again. I I think it probably is confusing because I myself am trying to craft a message. Actually, I think I'm trying to craft multiple messages, one that has to do something about the potentials for teaching in the space, and secondly, a message that has much more to do with poker strategic thinking. But my thought has been that I don't want to tell you what your message is. I want you to pick what your message is. And I don't necessarily insist that if somebody wants to go along with somebody else's message, that's fine if you don't really feel you're ready to shoot with one. But my thought was, you project your message, and let's see how you represent your character in back of it, and how logically you present it, and with what kind of feeling it comes through.
Because when we talked this morning, we spoke briefly about this whole question of the message, and what I got from what you were saying, which really rang true to me, was that as we approach that this whole cyberspace medium, it's a medium of communication that has allowed communication in so many different angles and has opened up the communication space to so many different people in a way that just hasn't been seen before. And that traditionally we've had the courts as a way to sort of find truth or something approximating truth that's acceptable, but cyberspace has sort of turned that on its ear just because of all the various ways of communicating. Now, boundaries of jurisdiction don't make sense anymore, and there's all sorts of disputes, and so you have to be able to operate in this cyberspace medium. So this whole process of crafting a message and getting it out there, I mean, isn't so much about the message, although, of course, whatever your message is important, but in that it's important for us to develop these skills of empathic argument, is to develop this ability to understand how you communicate a message in this new medium that we have. And like you were saying yesterday, law school seems to sort for people who can go through combative argument very well. But until another party understands that you understand what they're saying, they're only going to be trying to convince you or trying to make you understand their point. So until they think that you understand them, they're just going to be banging you over the head with, why don't you get what I'm saying? If only you understood what I was saying, you'd know I was right. And so once so that whole concept fits into this whole court of public opinion idea. How do you communicate your message in a way that makes people understand, I know what you're saying, but it's better, but whatever I'm saying still makes sense because of this. That was sort of what I gathered from what we were talking about this morning, why it's important to develop this ability.
Yes, Andrew and I, well, it put me in mind of, you know, I described Archie Cox to you yesterday. You would often, when Cox was asked a question, he would answer it best he could. And if the person who asked him the question wasn't satisfied and asked him, you know, pressed, Archie somehow always had a way of responding in different language than he had before, taking a different way of trying to get the argument across. And he seemed to be able to do that almost endlessly. He was just so patient and tolerant of the person who was asking him the question, as compared to this is a guy named Wayne Barnett, who was a very prominent tax teacher who argued a complicated tax case in the Supreme Court called Clay Brown, which is a big deal. And I watched him, and Justice Brennan asked him a question, and Wayne explained this answer to him. And it was clear Brennan didn't get it. He pressed again. Wayne explained it again, pretty much the same way. Brennan doesn't back down, so Brennan came back to him again. Wayne explained it again. You could start to see his gorge rise. And Brennan kept at it. They went 7 times. And by the 7th time that Brennan asked him the question, Wayne was spitting mad at him, just almost yelling at him. It was like you could almost hear him saying, "You dumb fuck." That's a terrible way to win an argument. You will not win an argument that way, right? So this idea of being able to hold your own in the argument and continue to be flexible and continue to be the observer in the situation and the worker of the situation. That's a great deal, to continue to understand the other person's question as best you can. Just keep at it. And if you don't, then you know you don't. It's not their fault, it's yours, that kind of approach. Yeah. All right, and more question about this? All right, cool. So, let me come back to this case. Part of the project. This is a case of poker chips that I bought for the public service auction this spring. It's like the measure of our success will be having the public service auction this spring. Now, under what circumstances we have it, I'm not completely sure yet. I would love to press through. From my point of view, from internet point of view, the constraints on the internet, on the flow of bits through the net, whether they come from politics, whether it's like going after, it doesn't make any difference what it is, whether it's whatever the filtration of the bits on the net, I'm opposed. I'm an advocate for an open net. And the constraint that's been put on online poker is offensive to me. The fact that it was put on in a way that was just not democratically respectable makes it more offensive to me. And the idea that I can't play, and my students can't play a public service benefit poker tournament without getting the permission of some commissioner is offensive to me. So, I was thinking that I would pass out to you as souvenirs of the day a poker chip for you to carry around. I hope. Bring to the public service auction. Would you like a poker chip? They're nice. They're really nice.
Black or red?
Try to suit that.
Who hasn't got one? So, I got a few more minutes. Part of my thought with this class is to see if I can convey the basic ideas of rhetoric to you. And in some ways that has to do with subjective understanding of the way people receive messages and the way we send them. So let me explain some things that seem maybe pretty far distant. If you start with the idea of, hold on, let me see if I can find the bookmark. You start with the idea of consciousness. It's something at least that I've found useful to understand in terms of our base brain, the source of our emotions, the source of our fight-flight instincts, and the higher cortex where the logical stuff happens. And it starts you off with the idea that in some sense consciousness has two sources. It's not just logic, it's not just feeling, it's some combination of both. When I discovered the Rastafarian religion, I identified with it immediately. I said, I'm a Rasta, because their conception of the self is I and I. They have this duality built right into their notion of their identity. So one vision, one way of understanding your identity is, all right, we tend to think that we figure things out with our head and then we do them. That's this idea of free will that we have. But it seems much more to represent the reality that we have decided what we do. We do what we do coming up from this amygdala, the deeper brain. And we then explain it to ourselves with the higher brain. We rationalize our emotions. Now, in law that has a tremendous effect. Yeah. Where am I? No, that's not what I want. Yeah. Excuse me here, I'm just taking a second. In law, it has a tremendous effect because when you are, here, don't look at that for a minute. When you are talking to a jury, for example, you are communicating at two different levels. One is an emotional level, and that communication starts from the moment you stood up, probably long before. You can call it the vibe, you can call it the warmth, whatever it is. It's an emotional exchange. And then there's the logic. And all right, so people are listening to you and taking in the logic of what you say, but they're also relating to you emotionally. And it turns out that when a signal comes into you through your eyes, let's say, it goes to these two parts of your self. But the instinctive part is so fast in its reaction that by the time your signal comes into your higher brain, you're also getting an emotional signal from your amygdala. And your brain has got to harmonize the logic of what you're hearing with the feeling. And the result is that feeling creates context for logic. If somebody hits you with a bad vibe from the beginning, what they say is going to seem like a bunch of lies. On the other hand, if somebody relates to you in a way that's warm from the beginning and you're open to them, you're just much more open to their message. All right, so this idea of context, it has dimensions in many parts of the way we express message. The idea that you can change meaning by changing context becomes just a key to us. Here, you see the big guy chasing the little guy? They're the same size. This one I'm sure you're all familiar with. had a wonderful experiment. I wonder if I've got it. No, I don't have. Sorry, I don't think I have what I need if I want to do that. Okay, so. All right. Just got a few minutes left. I'm excited about the idea that we can do this. Teaching can be just a lot of fun. And the idea of actually starting to think in production terms, I am hoping will be a lot of fun. Now, I don't know what it's going to take to just break us out of the mode that we're in. But I think we could start. So now, you said you were great on camera.
I mean, I look good in person too, so.
Yeah,
on camera.
I know.
It's just not.
So if we were thinking of this class somehow as producing itself, it would certainly be nice to have someone on camera talk right to the camera and explain what the whole situation is about.
Nice job. Found your man.
You found your man.
I can even like have a guitar and strum a little bit if you want.
Bring it in.
I will, as soon as it's not raining. And I'm not averse to nude scenes, so I mean, write whatever you want.
This is good, this is good.
Can I give you some advice? Don't try it out crazy, because pretty soon you're going to be standing here naked in a guitar.
Wouldn't be the first time this week.
Oh man, it's Friday already.
One of the reasons that I am, one of the features of this poker thing that's been most fascinating to me is the way the objections to it are structured in religious terms. I've been extremely interested in the Muslim take, the Islamic take on gambling. And In many ways, I've been surprised. And I just actually sat through a workshop yesterday led by Noah Feldman, who's joined our faculty and seems amazingly well-versed in the whole Islamic world. He was talking to our faculty yesterday in a workshop about who interprets the law, what is the source of law, and who interprets it. And with poker, the source seems to be a revelation of Muhammad called the Heifer, which has a citation, 219. And it seems very much like constitutional doctrine in its way. That is, it's written text, and it's there to be interpreted. And interestingly, there's an injunction in it, which some translations of it translate as an injunction against gambling, and which other translations translate as an edict against playing games of chance. And of course, one of the interesting features about the law of poker, both I think here in the United States and apparently in the Muslim world as well, is a distinction between what's a game of chance and what's a game of skill. And so the idea of establishing poker as a game of skill is actually the legal challenge to have it recognized as a game of skill. But the idea that it would be possible actually through this to engage the Islamic world on the question of how the law is interpreted. We did a conference at the Berkman Center, where we had a number of imams, and they interpret
what the prophet said. But as far as I can tell, there's no particular organization of imams. They seem very disaggregated, and they were longing for some internet method of getting together so that they could coordinate better. But the whole idea of democracy, to me, has to do with each of us in some way interpreting our law. We feel capable of interpreting our law to a large extent. And whether that idea, which seems so central to me here, was central in the Islamic view of law, was just a question that this seemed to raise. So I say that because it's the objections that are in many ways the most interesting. Thinking about what addiction is a very interesting subject. Thinking about the nature of moral objection and where it comes from and how one can approach it empathically. How the Christian right has an objection to poker. But suppose one wanted not just to overwhelm the Christian right, but you wanted actually to engage them. Would we be capable of having an empathic conversation that really started from an understanding of their feeling about it? Could we parse it in some way? That's the attraction to me in many ways of my particular project. And I'm hoping that in whatever goes on with respect to my project here, it embraces this empathic idea, that is, the notion of wanting the discussion of it and thinking that in many ways the discussion of it's even better than the playing of the game. So what do you say? When do you want to do a one-card war? Here, Will. Andrew, I'll put you in charge of that, okay? You figure out if and when we want to do that.
All right.
Okay?
Sure.
Good. All right, so on the wiki is the assignment. The assignment, I need to explain it just a touch. The assignment is to get familiar with Scratch. But the specific assignment is actually a problem set generated by my daughter Rebecca in her extension school class. And it consists of, it looks like a thing that's got points in it. It's basically a problem set. Don't worry, you're not being graded on it. It's just a thing to drive you through this and to focus you on the Scratch challenges. We're gonna open next week with Rebecca talking about Scratch in the virtual world. So, see you next week.